You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, sharing music, listening to a new artist. Seems like it's never been easier with streaming platforms like Spotify and Apple Music and more. But how does it change our relationship to the music, and how does it pay the artists? A Wisconsin music industry expert shows us the money. First, it's time for our Wisconsin News Roundup, checking in with journalists around the state about the stories they're covering. We start in Sheboygan County, where a proposal for a solar farm in the small town of Holland is getting some pushback from local officials and residents. Kristen Halbeck-Zeem is the Port Washington reporter for the Ozaukee Press. Chris, welcome back to Central Time.
My pleasure.
Well, give us the basic details of this solar farm proposal.
Well, a company called Ranger Power, which is based out of New York, is looking at installing a roughly 1,000 to 1,200-acre solar farm in the town of Holland, which is in southern Sheboygan County. They've signed leases with a number of the landowners they need. I believe they said they only needed one or two more. And then they are going to look at designing it and could ultimately have a solar farm up within a couple of years.
Let's look at the upside and then get into some local concerns. Upside, these farms could mean more revenue for local governments and the landowners who rent out the land. Do we know what kind of impact, economic impact, this could have in Holland?
Well, the town of Holland, Ranger Power has proposed a 150-megawatt farm, which would bring in, the state would collect roughly $600,000 in utility aid that they would give the town of Holland about $250,000 annually, and Sheboygan County, $350,000.
And something unique here, I think, about this and other operations by this business, they're not trying to get new transmission lines. They try to situate themselves where they can use already existing transmission infrastructure. Do I have that right?
You have that correct. Yeah, they pick places where there's a substation and lines that they can tap into.
You also talked to some local officials and area residents who have concerns about the project. What kind of things did you hear?
Well, I spoke to one woman who's very concerned because her property would be surrounded on three sides by this solar farm. She's concerned about everything from aesthetics, because obviously this would change what she looks at every day, property values, potential for contamination, the effect it could have on wildlife. They have sandhill cranes nesting along the Onion River that are just coming back, and she's worried it could impact them. And there's also, she's concerned that there could be the potential for stray voltage.
What has the company said about concerns they run into in local communities?
Well, they try to mitigate them as much as they can. You know, they said that they do have setbacks from surrounding homes and properties. They are willing to talk to landowners such as her, with the potential perhaps of landscape screening. So, you know, they're trying to do what they can as well.
And ultimately, who is the decider here? Is it a local government? Is it a state board? Who makes the decision to sign off on a project like this?
That would be the PSC. So it's out of the hands of the locals for the most part. Local government can negotiate some things, but it's pretty limited. The state government, I think, has looked at it and decided that in too many situations, locals would shut down big utility operations because a lot of people don't want that in their backyard. And obviously, we all use power. We all use electricity. So there has to be some give and take.
What's the timeline then on that decision? And then if it's approved, on when this could go into operation?
Well, Ranger is still trying to button down a couple more contracts with landowners. The state requires them to acquire at least 125% of the land it needs. So they have some leeway in siting it. They said that if all goes well, they'll apply for a permit sometime later this spring, perhaps, or maybe summer. And construction could begin, if everything falls into place, could begin by the end of next year, with construction taking a year to a year and a half.
Chris, thanks a lot for bringing us up to date.
Thank you.
Kristen Halbeck-Zeem is a reporter with the Ozaukee Press. She joined us to talk about a 1,000-acre solar farm being proposed in the town of Holland in Sheboygan County. Now we head to La Crosse, where city officials are discussing the idea of a fitness facility for people with disabilities and the senior population. Olivia Herkin is a reporter for the La Crosse Tribune. Olivia, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for having me.
Can you tell us about the vision, the concept for this STAR Center project that's being proposed in La Crosse?
Yeah, I definitely can. So this facility It's budgeted around $20 million, and it would be a space for people of all abilities, really, to exercise and be active and receive care. It would be all-encompassing, and so that means, you know, people who are able-bodied would be able to use this, but it would also be a space for those who maybe recently had surgery or those who are developmentally disabled or for the aging community to use. So really an all-inclusive facility for people to use. So it would be a space for general exercise, but people could also receive physical therapy and other treatments there as well.
Now, this is in the works, but a lot of steps remain. One is rezoning. The city council would have to rezone some land next week. What are you hearing arguments pro con there?
Yeah, I think, you know, it is the next hurdle, and it is kind of the last big one. And if it went through, it seems like the project would really have no issues going forward. And so I think a lot of city officials are trying to take a step back and make sure that it is the right move. It is a really big project. It's a big dream, I think a lot of people think. And so they really want to make sure that they are making the right decision by letting this go through. You know, it's going to cost a lot of money, and it also will be a tax-exempt facility. And so they're trying to be really cautious about how much money they will give to the project, knowing they're not going to get much out of it in regards to taxes.
Speaking of money, where would the funding for this project come from?
That is, you know, something that's on everybody's mind. $20 million is a lot of money, and the leaders behind the project are being kind of tight-lipped, and I think it's just because, you know, they don't have the rezoning yet. They haven't even bought the land yet officially, and so they want to make sure that they have all their ducks in a row before they unveil you know, who all is giving to this project. They're pretty confident that they would receive around $7 million in federal tax credits to fund the project. And they're also really confident that they would receive this Opportunity Zone grant from the state. It's a funding source that has been federally approved, but Governor Evers has yet to sign it. He's hopefully going to in April, they think. So they qualify for that, they know, but the exact dollar amount of that grant is still unknown. Otherwise, it's all just private donations so far, but they really haven't revealed how much they've raised already and how much they have yet to go.
As we wrap up, Olivia, it sounds like this would be a fairly unique project to this fitness center for people with different ability levels. Would this kind of put La Crosse on the map for having this unique facility?
I definitely think it would. From what I've heard from leaders of the project, it would definitely be a unique facility in the Midwest, but also it sounds like most of the country doesn't have a facility that meets all of these exact needs. And also, you know, it's being developed on La Crosse's north side, which is an area that often feels neglected. And so, yeah, I think that it would bring a lot more developmental diversity to the area, and I do think it would bring a lot more people to La Crosse.
Olivia, thanks a lot for joining us.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Olivia Herkin is a reporter at the La Crosse Tribune. She talked to us about plans there for an exercise and therapy center aimed at the senior population and people with disabilities. Now, the Telemark Lodge has a long history in Bayfield County, but it's been dormant since 2013. Now, a new group of developers is putting up a plan to reimagine the resort. Barry Adams covers regional and business news for the Wisconsin State Journal. Barry, welcome back.
Yeah, you bet, Rob.
Now, we've talked about the Telemark Lodge before. Remind us briefly of its up and down history in northern Wisconsin.
Yeah, so this is a resort. It started out as a ski resort in the 1940s. They added a lodge in the early 1970s. And, you know, it was pretty successful up until then. But then, you know, in the early 80s, there was a lot of changes in ownership and had many financial problems. And so it was a in and out of bankruptcy. It was at a sheriff's auction, and the lodge and ski hill closed in 2013.
Now, what's this new plan to redevelop it?
Well, the plan right now is unclear. You know, the American Birkebeiner Ski Foundation has an option to purchase 750 acres of the property, which includes where the lodge and ski hill sit. And a new organization called the Telemark Redevelopment, they're proposing a $41 million project that would tear down the original lodge and replace it with a 250-room lodge, and then they'd reopen the ski hill, but also create a training center for corporate events and things like that. There was a plan that was proposed last year in 2017 by HK Hospitality out of Florida. They wanted to do a $47 million project. That one has stalled, however. So, you know, right now, the driving seat, driving this thing right now is the American Birkebeiner Ski Foundation. They want to use the property, of course, for more events, for skiing and things like that. This is where the Birkebeiner starts every year. So right now it's kind of up in the hand in the court of the foundation.
And is it, I mean, is there a way that the Birkebeiner gets what they want and Telemark Redevelopment does something with the building? Is there, are these mutually exclusive, I guess I'm asking?
Right. No. And that's kind of the plan. I think what the Telemark Redevelopment folks are hoping for is that, and the foundation, the ski foundation, they want nothing to do with lodging and restaurants and things like that. So I think they're very welcome to that type of arrangement. It's just unclear, but there could be other developers that come along and say, hey, here's a better plan.
Before we let you go, Barry, it seems like at the heart of this is this idea locally that there's a lot of potential here, a lot of economic potential that keeps not happening. Is this kind of a long-running dream in the area to make something work here?
Yeah, it's like every time they propose something here, it's kind of like, okay, is this one going to, you know, pan out? So I think until the contracts are signed and we see the first bulldozer arrive and the first spades of dirt being turned, I think that's when people will finally believe that something good and good change is going to happen here at Telemark. But it's been it's had a very long, turbulent past.
Barry, thanks a lot for joining us.
All right, you bet, Rob.
Barry Adams covers regional and business news for the Wisconsin State Journal. He talked with us about a new plan to redevelop the Telemark Lodge in Cable and finished out our Wisconsin News Roundup. Coming up, does streaming your favorite song on repeat mean more money for the artist you love? It might, but how much? That depends. We'll talk about the complicated system of making money as a musician in the digital age. That's up next on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the number of images of child exploitation online was called an epidemic over 10 years ago. Now the system meant to stop it is at a breaking point. We talked to a New York Times reporter behind an investigation into the problem. First, music industry revenue increased by 13% last year, largely thanks to more people paying a subscription fee to access on-demand music on platforms like Spotify or Apple Music. In theory, more people paying for music means more money for artists to get paid, but the system is more complicated than that. While we clearly embrace the ability to listen to any song anywhere without hauling around a CD binder, and digital downloads of MP3s are fading into the past, it's not clear what it all means for musicians making money. Jeremy Morris is an associate professor in media and cultural studies at UW-Madison. He researches the current state of the popular music industry, new media and digital culture, and the technologies of music production and consumption. He wrote the book Selling Digital Music, Formatting Culture. Jeremy, thanks a lot for coming up to the studio.
Thanks for having me.
Well, things have changed fast, just in the last 10, 20 years. For the people creating music, what is this shift from physical media to downloads to now streaming meant for them?
Yeah, well, I think it's meant a lot of things. I mean, you know, you went through this period of time where the CD was really the prime commodity that everybody was buying in 1999, 2000s, and then you have the introduction of file sharing. You have this kind of period of disruption where people aren't sure what's going on. You have the emergence of being able to download single songs, and then streaming comes along sort of, you know, in the 2010s, right? So you have three different formats really kind of clumped together all in a quick span. So trying to adjust to that as a musician has meant a lot of different things, right? Figuring out how these new systems work, figuring out how to continue to get your music out there and get it heard. I mean, I think the problems facing musicians have been the same throughout, right? How do we get our music heard if we're a local band, right? How do we get it out there? How do we get it heard by listeners? And then, yeah, how do we make enough off of that to be able to sustain making music for our lives?
I've seen the case made that one of the most important musical innovations from Mick Jagger of the Rolling Stones was how to make sure the people in the band actually made money as opposed to just the businesses selling their vinyl. In that case, things haven't changed that much in some ways?
Well, I would say there are a lot of intermediaries that are in between, you know, the musician and the user who puts down some money to pay for whatever they're paying for. So, yeah, the labels take a cut. There are distribution sites that take a cut. So there's a whole bunch of different players that are involved in the process of distributing royalties. So, yeah, musicians are often on the kind of lower end of that scale. I think in the CD era, we were talking, you know, maybe 10%, 12% of each CD sold would go to artists. It's still unclear exactly what that is in the streaming era, but we're thinking around 8 to 10% as well, right? So even though the technologies have changed, the percentage that's going to artists is still quite minimal.
I've seen the case made that for some, you know, not your most famous artists in the world, but for maybe a mid-level act, the way to make money now is you try to get the publicity through your online presence and your streaming. And then you go back to really a live show and selling physical stuff, and that's where some artists at least are able to make some money.
Yep, there's no doubt that the internet and digital distribution gives huge opportunities for exposure. That's not to say that everybody can just put their stuff out there and it's going to get seen, right? There are still intermediaries in there. There are still companies like Spotify and Apple that recommend certain songs over others, right? So getting heard is still a challenge for all artists. It is definitely the case that people like the exposure that something like Spotify or the internet gives them. They can make money off of that either through YouTube or through traditional channels. There's starting to be a lot of different ways in which artists are trying to figure out, oh, can I make money, you know, selling T-shirts? Is this going to be my model? Am I going to rely on concert tickets? You know, I think the truth is, like it always has been, it's going to be a mix of revenue streams that artists are looking for.
And some artists, I understand, are trying to game the streaming systems. If you're making whatever, 0.001 cents per listen, people have gotten creative in how they put tracks online.
Right, yeah. I mean, with Spotify and Apple and Google Play, like these streaming services, they really do pay, you know, fractions of a penny per stream. And artists have started to realize this, and other companies that are in the music industries have started to realize this. So they've started thinking about ways to kind of be creative about that. Those services often also only pay out after a certain amount of time. So there was a band, I guess one of the good examples is a band called Wolfpack. They released an album called Sleepify. And it was I think 12 or 13 songs, but they were all 35 seconds of silence. And each track was called like Z, 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 like snoring, you know. And they basically encouraged their fans to listen to it overnight on repeat as they slept. And they ended up garnering enough plays to get about $20,000 in royalties just from that kind of a system, you know. But there are less kind of fun and funny stories about that. People designing bots to try and, you know, fake plays so that they can kind of game the system that way. And the way Spotify pays out its royalties is problematic in that way, right? They have a kind of a pool of all the streams that have happened, and then they have a pool of royalties to devote to that, and they pay it out by percentage. You know, so it's not necessarily like if you press play on your favorite band, that band is going to get, you know, the fractions of cents from your play, right? It depends on the entire pool that's been played in that payout period.
Talking to Jeremy Morris from UW-Madison, looking at the way music works in the streaming age for bands. And now let's switch over to the consumer. There's always a concern, maybe hand-wringing, okay, we're getting our music in a new way, the sheet music, vinyl, CD, streaming, whatever. What do you think has changed about our relationship to the music we listen to now with the streaming services?
Well, I think there's, you know, on the positive sides, you got a whole bunch of great access to songs you might not have ever had before, right? If you wanted to explore the discography of a band that you loved, you can literally listen to all of their albums, you know, for a fairly convenient price. And you could take in a significant amount of music for a much more reasonable price than if you were trying to buy a physical CD. But it's also meant that we've given up a lot in the process. We're giving up a lot of data about our own listening habits. We're creating a huge repository of data for companies like Spotify and Apple to use that in targeting advertising towards you and personalization and all these other things that we're not even entirely sure of what that data is being used for yet. So, you know, on the one hand, I think there's some great, benefits of convenience and ease of access. But then we're also getting sort of those questions about, you know, who's listening to our listening habits and what are they doing with that information?
And, you know, as a musician who's zen with the idea of never making money doing it, I do wonder when I stream, like, should I feel guilty? Like, I'm not stealing it here. It's a legal service. But am I ripping off the musicians who made this stuff when I stream it for free for me?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know, right? I'm sure when you listen to radio, you didn't think the same kind of thought, right? You weren't like...
That's true.
And it's a bit of a different scenario because, you know, again, the royalty payout for radio plays versus streams are a bit different. But, you know, many people see streaming like that kind of an exposure. And the truth is we have bands in our lives that fulfill a number of roles. Some bands you listen to because you want to hear their song every once in a while. Other one you're maybe a super fan of, right? So if you're really into a band, you're probably going to explore that relationship a little bit more. So if you're streaming them a ton, you're also maybe probably buying something at a show. If you go and see one of their shows, you're investing in them in some other way.
Is this hard? As somebody who follows this, it seems like the change is happening so fast with the technology and the newest streaming sites and whatever is coming next. We don't even know yet. Is it hard to keep track of this stuff?
It's definitely hard to keep up with it, but I think it's also exciting in that sense. There are some really neat, interesting new developments. I go to music technology conferences, and there's a lot of people talking about ways to use the blockchain to deliver or to pay out royalties more fairly. I mean, part of the big problem with streaming is that it's hard to track down all the people who were involved in the creation of a song and therefore to pay that out properly. So what people are looking into is ways of using digital currency and digital contracts to kind of set up a system in which everybody who's contributed to the making of a song is getting some portion of the funds that that song generates. So
you say blockchain, and that makes me think this is going to be really hard to be a listener of this. From the listener side of things, is it going to be less complicated than it sounds?
At the moment, it isn't. I think it will get easier. They're going to be, you know, and you see some of this stuff already on you know, sites like Bandcamp, where there's just a more direct relationship between the artist and the user. And you know, if you're a listener, I can support this band by paying this much for their MP3, or I can listen to it, you know, streaming on this site. And they give you this sort of options, right? So I think as long as musicians are trying to create that relationship with their listeners, and listeners are sort of invested in that, that's gonna turn out well.
Jeremy, thanks a lot for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
That's Jeremy Morris, Associate Professor in Media and Cultural Studies at UW-Madison, author of the book Selling Digital Music, Formatting Culture, looking at our changing relationship with the music world as listeners and as musicians. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up Monday at 6 on The Morning Show, after this weekend's International Women's Day, Kate Archer-Kent and her guests look at women's activism and their role in political change around the world. That's Monday morning at 6 here on the Ideas Network. Now, a warning for listeners, we're going to be talking about child exploitation. For the next half hour, the discussion may not be suitable for children. The spread of child sexual abuse images online was called an epidemic over a decade ago. Today, the problem has only gotten worse. The internet has made sharing those images and videos easier than before, and our next guest says that's been accompanied by failures on the part of big technology companies and regulators in the federal government to take meaningful steps to stop it. Michael Keller is a reporter and data journalist for the New York Times investigative team. He co-reported the piece headlined, "The Internet is Overrun with Images of Child Sexual Abuse. What Went Wrong?" Michael, thanks for being with us today.
Hi, thanks for having me.
I had no idea the scope of what's going on here. Can you give us a sense of how big this problem is today?
Yeah, sure thing. This was surprising for us also to learn over the course of this investigation. We found that really over the last 20 years, in the late 90s, when this started to be recorded more diligently, there were about 3,000 reports of images of explicit images of children circulating online. About 10 years after that, there were about 200,000. And then last year, there were nearly 17 million reports, including about 70 million images and videos inside in those reports. So really a growth that at times doubles year to year. And over the past 20 years, as you said, 10 years ago, it was called an epidemic. And since then, it's really only increased.
I think if people hear the phrase child pornography, it sounds bad. And from what you reported on, things are worse than that image even conjures up without getting too graphic. Can you give us a sense of what's out there?
Yeah, I think when most people hear that term, they think of maybe young teenagers posing erotically. And I think while that would still clearly be illegal, what we learned is that it's much worse. It's often the graphic depiction of the rape of infants and toddlers, children even as young as that, which is extremely surprising. And that's not even the edge cases. That's not the small number. We learned that many local law enforcement and even the FBI, while they're always investigating cases where there's imminent harm to a child, they often have to prioritize the tips they get to those just concerning infants and toddlers. They have so many coming in, and in many cases, not enough resources to handle the volume.
What led you into this investigation initially?
We originally got a tip from a reader, actually. They wrote us saying that they inadvertently stumbled across explicit images of children when they were using Microsoft's Bing search engine, which was pretty surprising. They were searching for unrelated terms, and the search engine itself started suggesting these other terms. And if you clicked on that, it led you down kind of one of these rabbit holes and started returning images of naked children. They wrote to us extremely concerned. We looked into it and found that it checked out. We reported it to the FBI immediately and then started our own investigation. Because it is illegal to even look at these images, and so we advise people don't try and go looking yourself. We still wanted to investigate further. What we ended up doing was we wrote a computer program that could replicate that tipster's search without us actually being at the computer and seeing the results. It could then block the images that came back and compare the URL of the image, so where the web address was without actually seeing it, used a technology that actually Microsoft itself developed that could tell you if that image is a previously identified one. And to our surprise, we actually found that 75 images matched known examples of child sexual abuse material on Microsoft's servers using Microsoft's own software to detect it, really raising questions about the efforts that even the companies that are developing tools to capture this material, to detect it, whether they're using their own tools. The company ended up telling us that it was a bug that those images slipped through. When we tried it then a couple weeks later, we found even more. So it was concerning and part of a larger investigation we did that found a number of policy gaps and decisions that companies took that ultimately lead to many of these images slipping through.
Michael Keller is with us from the New York Times investigative team talking about an investigation into images and videos of child sexual abuse all over the internet. Before we dig into some of the things that went wrong along the way at a lot of different levels, Michael, there's new news this week, efforts in Congress based in large part on your reporting. What are we seeing?
Yeah, there were two measures this week, and they're one of them is a part of a larger push in Congress to try and address this issue. One was a set of voluntary guidelines that the Department of Justice, in conjunction with four foreign governments, put out, as well as industry. They essentially worked together to come up with a set of voluntary guidelines they could all agree to for companies to better police and detect this material on their platforms. The second one is a bill that was introduced by Senators Lindsey Graham of South Carolina and Richard Blumenthal of Connecticut, a bipartisan bill that would essentially increase the accountability for technology companies. It would expose them to civil liability if they didn't follow forthcoming guidelines. So we'll set up a group that will work to create a series of best practices that the industry should adopt. And for companies that don't adopt them, they could expose themselves to some serious liability, which is a pretty extraordinary step and something that for over 20 years, the internet companies have been free from such lawsuits.
There was funding given years ago after this was first found to be an epidemic, even though it was at much lower levels. What happened with that federal funding that was supposed to lead efforts to crack down on these kind of images and videos?
In 2008, there was a landmark bill that was passed that, as you said, when this was called an epidemic, it spurred a lot of action in Washington. And one of the results was a dedicated yearly stream of revenue for investigators that are looking into this problem. The trouble is that even though the numbers seem to double every year in terms of how many images are found, the funding has not kept pace. And so you still only see about $30 million a year allocated to local investigators. And since our reporting, there's been recent calls to increase that. And so that will certainly be something interesting to watch. One of the other big parts of that bill was the Department of Justice was supposed to come out with reports every 2 years, essentially national strategy reports, trying to devise a way to tackle the problem, to help investigators say, how can you better find the offenders that are at risk of actually harming a child? What is the scope of it? How many children are involved? How many images are out there? And unfortunately, only two of those reports have ever been published in 10 years, even though they're supposed to have been coming out every other year. So that's certainly concerning. When we spoke with one of the authors of the bill, Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz, she has been trying to get answers from the Department of Justice about why those reports have not been coming out more frequently, and so far has not gotten an answer.
Let's look at the role of the technology companies themselves. One case in Wisconsin you report, I think it was Tumblr, I can't remember for sure, that had reported images like this to the police, but tipped off their user had posted their image, you have been referred to police investigation, giving them time to delete files. What can you talk about the sort of things we see from the companies themselves?
Yeah, one of the issues around that is how these companies work with investigators. And so there's actually another bill that was been introduced in both the House and the Senate. Representative Anthony Gonzalez of Ohio in the House spearheaded it, that would actually increase the amount of time for a company to retain evidence. So if they find a user has posted child sexual abuse material, they're supposed to notify the authorities and take it down and then hold on to it so that when law enforcement comes, they have evidence and they can try and track down who it is. We found in some cases, as you mentioned in that scenario, they are notifying the user, and that leads to a loss of evidence. Sometimes because law enforcement, they're so overwhelmed, it takes them longer than 90 days. And so by the time they come back to the company says, we don't actually have any of this data. And so what that bill would do is it would double the amount of time a company has to hold on to it to try and help law enforcement as they investigate these crimes. The other thing that we found is that many technology companies such as Google Drive or Dropbox, these cloud storage companies, don't scan every file that is uploaded to them. They may only do it under certain circumstances or in certain cases. And so we reviewed, I think, nearly 10,000 pages of court documents. And what you'd often see is they may get a tip from a company based on one file that happened to be scanned. And then when investigators go in and look further, they'll actually find thousands. And in some cases, it may actually lead them to an active, ongoing abuse of a child. So when we speak with experts in the technology field, they say, there is a lot being found, certainly, since you see that in the reporting numbers. But that really is just the tip of the iceberg. And that if these companies increase their detection efforts, you'd be seeing a whole lot more.
We're talking to Michael Keller, reporter and data journalist for the New York Times investigative team. We're talking about his investigation into images and videos of child exploitation being shared online. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been affected by this issue yourself or in your family, if you're willing to share that story? If you work in law enforcement or child protective services, what does this problem look like from where you're sitting? Do you have questions about how to protect your children from predators online? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Michael Keller of the New York Times. We're talking about his investigation into a huge rise in the number of photos and videos of child exploitation and abuse being shared online. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you've worked in law enforcement or with victims or child protection, have you encountered these issues yourself or in your own family? Or do you have questions for our guest? You can join in at 800-642-1234. 1234. We'll go to your calls now. Kathy is with us in Appleton. Kathy, hello.
Howdy. My question has to do with what are we doing as a society or as a culture that is producing so many perpetrators? You know, for years we focused a lot, which needed to be, on victims. And so we understand the impact of sexual abuse on victims. But I find we haven't really focused on the perpetrators and what is driving all this behavior.
Kathy, thanks for the call. That's a huge question. Michael, from your investigations, what do we know about the perpetrators and the rings, the communities, in a way, of people sharing these images and videos?
It's a really good question, and it's something that was on our minds a lot in this investigation. Whenever you see numbers rising so much, you always ask yourself, is this because we're getting better at detecting it? Is it because there's new behavior happening? And I think in this case, it's a little bit of both. You have, it's never been easier to take a picture or a video and share it since you have smartphones. But I think the other dynamic that's at play here is also, if you are on the offender side, you now have a community of people that you can go online. Let's say you're someone who has a sexual interest in children. Before the internet, you didn't have anyone to talk to about that. Now you can go online and find people who will tell you that's totally normal. Here's other images that I have. Here's an app that you can use to talk to kids. Here's an app you can use to share images and videos with us. And encourage the behavior, which is certainly very concerning, since obviously it's not normal or appropriate to have sexual interest in children. But similar to how, you know, radicalization in other areas happens, people often say that this is something that now is leading to more offenders.
I want to talk a little more about the impact on victims, not just the initial instances of abuse now, but these images and videos being online theoretically forever. I want to listen to a family anonymously you talked to. They've been trying to get images of their daughter taken down from the internet.
What if it was your daughter?
Yeah. You know, put yourself in that kid's shoes.
What if you were the person they're looking at the rest of your life? If we could tell that this happened instead of this is happening, the world would be a lot better off. She'll be a lot better off.
What ability do victims and their families have to try to get these things off the internet? It sounds almost impossible.
We definitely heard a lot of frustration from the families of victims and even from some of the victims themselves. They feel that even though the abuse happened in some case 10 years ago, the idea that people are still looking at images of the event, essentially one of the worst moments, if not the worst moment in your entire life, and getting pleasure out of that, is a big impediment to them moving forward with their life. They feel that sometimes people think it's just pictures, but it's really so much more than that. As one person, a woman who at age 11 had been filmed being sexually assaulted by her father, who's now an adult, she said, "You're just trying to feel okay and not let something like this define your whole life." But the thing with the pictures, she said, is that's what keeps this alive. They often expressed feelings of guilt that they have, which is it's obviously not their fault, but they feel like images of them can be used to coerce other children. If an offender goes online and starts talking to a child and says, oh, it's totally normal for adults and children to have a sexual relationship, which is obviously not true, but they can say, here's a photo of it. And this is, you know, what we should do. We should meet in person. So it's both incredibly harmful to the person in the photo, but also to other children who may be brought into this abuse as a result of that. One of the big fears we heard over and over again was people are so concerned about being recognized in real life from the photos. It really follows them into adulthood.
Let's bring out another caller now. Laura is with us in Superior. Laura, hello.
Hi, thanks so much for taking my call. I appreciate you bringing and highlighting this issue. I'm a forensic interviewer at a child advocacy center in Duluth, Minnesota. And we just don't see the resources, even though we have amazing trained staff in our ICAC unit, Internet Crimes Against Children. There's no way they can go through hundreds of thousands of images. It's so backlogged that we worry about the hands-on offenses, and interviewing children that are alleged victims of internet crimes is also a whole nother ball of wax. And it's very challenging to get these children to disclose because of the exact reasons the researcher and person from the New York Times is just talking about.
Laura, thanks for the call. Michael, that's in Duluth, and that's not just in Duluth. The system is overwhelmed at the national level, locally, everywhere, right?
Right. And I think as the caller rightly pointed out, the investigators, they're called Internet Crimes Against Children units, they have so many reports and tips coming in that they told us they often don't have the time to prioritize undercover or what they call proactive investigations. This is where they may pose either as a child and find an offender that wants to meet that child in real life, or they may pose as an adult looking for other like-minded individuals. And they say that those are extremely fruitful investigations, and they wish they had more time to prioritize them, but they just simply don't in many instances.
Thanks for that call. Michael, in our last couple of minutes, this is a very distressing story, but you've seen a lot of response from Congress and elsewhere that is maybe encouraging that people are starting to take this seriously. Give us some of the bright spots you're seeing since your reporting came out and how people are responding.
We've seen some companies increase their detection efforts. One instance, Snap is now looking into scanning for videos in addition to images. We've seen a big international response among groups that are looking to fund more of this work and more detection efforts. I think some of the bills that we mentioned that are looking to increase the funding in the U.S. are encouraging. And even though this is a really global problem, pretty much any internet platform anywhere around the world is going to have people coming to it to try and share this imagery, or if there are children on the platform, to talk to children on the platform. The U.S. really serves as in a unique role because of all of the Silicon Valley giants that are, you know, U.S. companies. So I think it is encouraging that now Congress is looking at, all right, what can we do at the Department of Justice to step up enforcement of the existing laws? What can we do to increase funding for the local investigators? And then these two efforts to try and draw up guidelines or best practices that the technology sector can deploy high tide rises all boats. So I think some people are encouraged by that. There are some other groups, such as privacy advocates, who worry that increased scanning or detection raises specters of more surveillance. And I think those are definitely justified concerns and worth an interesting debate and discussion. And so that's been a really interesting conversation to watch happen.
Michael, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Michael Keller from the New York Times investigative team. He was with us today to talk about his investigation into images and videos of child sex abuse on the internet. You can find his reporting along with tips to protect children from online predators. We've got linked on our website, wpr.org/centraltime. Coming up Monday on Central Time, new grants will help local governments develop roads, bike lanes, and other transportation infrastructure in Wisconsin. We'll find out what's in the works, and we'll get an inside look at a new WPR series that tells the story of some classic Wisconsin food products and how they're changing in an era of global warming. We'll start things off with the potato. That and more coming up Monday here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show with Kate Archer Kent. Monday at 7, the novel coronavirus continues to be a concern here in the U.S. Kate talks to a state health official about the latest developments, how the state is responding, and what the public can do to react without overreacting. That's Monday at 7:30 on the morning show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then it's time for this week's edition of Food Friday. We're focusing on oatmeal. We'll talk about the different kinds of oatmeal, how to fix the perfect bowl, and how to use it in a lot of our cooking. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.